Welcome to Culture Chats, an accessible discussion intertwining cultural and social issues while delving into the minds of some of the leading contemporary voices in Irish culture. Today I will be hosting a discussion focusing on sustaining a career in the arts. I chat with some of Ireland's most successful artists who over their creative careers have made important contributions and impact into the development of contemporary Irish culture. We chat about the highs and lows of working in the arts, tips for their peers, and focus on the journeys that led them to gaining international recognition. Today's episode features Amanda Coogan, an internationally recognised and critically acclaimed artist working across live art, performance, photography and video. Philip McMahon, a playwright and director and is co-founder of award-winning theatre company This Is Pop Baby. Una Mullally, a writer, journalist and broadcaster. Paddy Courtney, an actor and writer best known for appearing in A Bump Along the Way, Safe and Paddy Wackery. And Philip Connaughton, an award-winning choreographer and performer. And I'm Matthew Nevin, co-director of the Mark Gallery and Studios and also CICLA, the Contemporary Irish Arts Centre Los Angeles. I work as a curator, filmmaker and artist and have worked on some big projects and many little ones. I want to bring my experience and the experience of others together to build a better future for our culture.
I was thinking on the way here about what COVID has taken away from us is those moments where we can sit around and have a chat, obviously in a pub, or it's the incidental conversations where new and exciting ideas might come. Obviously, some people were very active in COVID and making stuff. How did, I suppose, anyone here around the table deal with it themselves? And I suppose I'll talk for myself, is what I missed was just those random conversations, meeting new people, not just friends, but like meeting those new people and going, oh yeah, I met that person and now I'm working with them on a new project. Because people did, I'm sure like yourself, you might have worked with collaborators that you've always worked with because it was easy. You're like, okay, I can actually work with this person because we know each other and we're going to Skype and we're going to get through this shit show. But what the pandemic stopped was maybe some of that new stuff. Or how did you deal with the pandemic? And
well, first of all, as the pandemic hit, and I can't remember the date, was it March 13th that the government, 2020, that the government closed all cultural institutions, and that was our opening night for a festival called Where We Live. This is Pop Baby, and there was 22 shows, 22 individual shows over 11 nights, 77 artists. And so we actually, when they closed the institutions, we ran the show privately, like as in, when I say privately, I mean to ourselves, so that it had happened, like the opening show or whatever. So that was kind of like the, you know, we've been calling it the psychic roller coaster. And so, you know, the closures and the hits kept coming. So for the first while, of course, there was a sense of excitement as well. There was a sense of like, you know, that kind of doomed excitement about like what's going to happen. But as kind of the work that we'd, you know, to make a theatre show, you prep for 2 years or whatever, you know, and to engage 77 artists, you've got to pull a lot of things together. So the first part of it was kind of extraordinarily, I don't know, high octane in loads of ways. It was upsetting and it was crazy and it was exciting. And then there was just the sense of, you know, there was the pit of despair waiting just down the road from us. But actually out of that came a lot of really interesting conversations and linking up with friends in other ways, like artistic friends. And out of that came some good, I guess, you know, work, you would call it, as in like, you know, planning for recovery. You know, what does the next part look like? Rather than, you know, just trying to grip onto the sides in a way and trying to kind of say, well, there is going to be a next part. So what does that look like? And how do we all do that together? So, yeah. And within that, I bought a sewing machine and baked lemon drizzle cake and drank every cocktail under the sun.
Well, I was just going to say baking. Come on, let's talk about the cocktails that we can see.
Like flat lemon drizzle cakes. It wasn't like, there wasn't, you know, we weren't getting a bake-off kind of quality.
I remember talking to you about it and your experience and actually just trying to find the joy and the enjoyment of some of it.
Yeah,
of lockdown.
Yeah, which was about cocktail making, really. No, I think you're right, though, Philly. At the start, we were like, everything. First of all, the terror as a freelancer, everything has just gone off the agenda. And, oh, my God, am I going to be on beans on toast for, like, the next month or two? And then going, well, actually, it's a little, you know, holiday. And so we did bake bread and, you know, pick wild garlic and drink makey uppy cocktails. It was like, what do we have in this? Oh, did I know that we had amaretto? Jimmy Walk, we'd make them. So there was a bit of crack there, and then the kind of, I think the fear started coming in then around, you know, a couple of months later. It's like, am I ever going to get these gigs? Because I think we probably all were in the middle of something that was ready to launch. I mean, it could be paused by a month or two, and we thought the exhibitions or the performances would be pushed on. But then it was like, this is not, is this ever? Am I ever going to be live again? Yeah.
Experienced it in your field and life?
I don't know. Like, it's totally wild, and I don't think, you know, I was talking to Michael Harding recently, and he was like, we don't know whether we're getting through something or at the foothills of something else. And I think that's probably like a realistic summation of how we're going to traverse a world in which this is an occurrence. And, you know, I'm not a pessimistic person, but I think, you know, the work that was done during this period, you know, some people were able to go into that realm, and some people were more prolific, and other people were just, you know, paralyzed by depression and all those kind of things, and I think most of us were all of those things during multiple times. But I think the real change that has happened, this isn't answering your question, I'm just talking about something else.
It's
like the personal work that has been done during this period, and, you know, spiritual work, self-reflection, digging into the psyche, you know, rooting up all these old traumas and thinking about your life and what got you here and being existential. And I think that will feed the tone of what comes next, whether that's very, very luminous, you know, roaring 20s, hedonistic, you know, new rave, or whether it's very, whether it's kind of a psychedelic, surrealist type period, or whether it's also like, you know, kind of nihilistic, uncertain in this like liminal space between thing moment that I think a lot of people are kind of occupying even in their daily lives. So I'm interested in, you know, in 5 years' time, 6 years' time, when we see the kind of work that has been germinating now, what that is. Because I don't think until then, I think one of the reasons that it's been so hard to hang your hat on anything right now is because a lot of the art that has been made about the pandemic, you know, is very kind of superficial, really, because it's, you know, it's happening. So I think that when we get to a phase where people have actually digested things, we'll look at the art and go, oh, yeah, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of hard to do that now.
I also wonder how we look at it then, again, as I say, in those years to come, that will we look on work that was made now across the board to go, oh, that was COVID work. Or, like, it just, you know, that didn't stem from your own soul without it being influenced by the shit that's going on elsewhere. Whereas I think of the kids that are doing exams at the moment, or have done for the last couple of years, like, will it come to, when they went into the big bad world, they'll kind of go, yeah, but they were COVID results. You know, they're not the real ones. So I think everybody, there was people, I didn't do a lot during COVID. I got re-engaged with nature again, and I live beside a beach, and I kind of start collecting shells and shit like that, and talking to robins on my back wall. And I was kind of lucky in that the Friday of lockdown, we had just finished a 5-week shoot of a kids' TV show. So we automatically were going into a dungeon anyway to go and edit this. So we kind of missed it. And I was like Philly as well, that, like, I was excited about the impending zombie apocalypse, and was kind of thinking that if we come out, maybe we'd get rid of a lot of people or situations in the world that kind of needed to be got rid of, but it just kept getting worse and worse. So I'm just curious to see what will the work be like, because we've heard of people who've gone and written a book and gone and written a screenplay.
Yeah.
And well done, and I tip my hat, congratulations, but will it be any use?
It's like, will this be the catalyst of something new, or will we look back on it and go, actually, as you said, that was just a very rough time, and this is a period of time that we'll just look on and go, okay, that's a certain way, or is it afterwards? But it reminds me of this whole idea of like creating work, and when is this trigger that when you might want to create new work? Everyone has these triggers or catalysts of starting new work. Maybe it's a friend who comes to you and goes, I have this idea, will you be in it? Or it's you're sitting down or you're in the shower or like you're going to the toilet or whatever it is, you're like, oh my God, that's what I'm going to do. Or it's, for me, it's a lot of the time is when I'm not thinking about it, or I'm suddenly going, oh yeah, that's what I want to actually do, or making those decisions. What about yourself, Philip? I suppose, trying to move away from COVID, but looking at the triggers and how you create work, what does your practice look like in that way?
Well, it's lots of things. It's not just any one thing. I suppose it's, you know, ideas that are accumulating over a long, long time, beside, you know, needing to come up with an idea because you need funding to survive. So then that kind of becomes part of it. And it's kind of, I think it's constantly a balancing act. And then, of course, collaborations with fellow artists. And so I think it's just being open to every possibility and trying to sneak in everything that you want to at the same time, you know? Definitely for me, I think these days, I'm obviously trying to get away from the whole COVID thing, but I think these days I'm aware of kind of the aftermath a little bit more, just, you know, since theatre started opening and work's been made, you know, the second half of this year, perhaps. And just thinking about, when I look back on the last 6 months, I just think, oh my God, I just managed to get here. It's like, because you're carrying a weight with you in, throughout every creative process, which is just, oh, I've managed to get it open and running, or I've managed to get through rehearsals and no one's died, or you know, no one's got sick, and we've managed to fill it. And so, so kind of in relation to what you're saying with, you know, the exams and the whole, the way you value something, or the kind of where you hold it as there's still a survival mechanism in there.
See, I suppose we have the baggage of, because everything you're saying there, a lot of it is, applies to our normal life anyway, of like you're creating things and you have the baggage of what you've just come from and what you're doing and what you're going to do next. And just thinking about how have any of you kind of, or how do you deal with that, with the baggage of the pressure of what you're going to do next?
Well, I'm a deadline junkie, which was my problem for during the lockdown when, you know, nothing was open actually. But you know what was really interesting? And I don't know if it was something we were saying, you know, off camera, is that I think there was something funky in the lockdown where I started, I know I was articulating it as I'm in a dreamscape, but kind of ideas were kind of really lucid and disconnected and not as rational as I would if I was commissioned to make a piece about it. I was kind of like brilliantly trippy.
Yeah.
And surrealism.
Articulated so much better. Yeah, but a kind of kaleidoscopic that I didn't really care if the ideas were, you know, formally knitting together quite nicely. I was just like, no, she could wear tights on her head and actually I'm going to cut out a hole. Why? I don't care. But, and, you know, birds coming out of my arse. That's, you know, these kind of things. I was just like, drawing them. And
we are in a kind of a psychedelic era. We're like era pre-pandemic as well, and then the whole trip of this thing I think has really reinforced that, you know, the, like, it's ridiculous obviously what's going on, you know. So then everything, all bets are off, and you can basically do, and I think people are really responding to, you know, surrealism. I think we are in a new surrealist phase of art.
And when you were locked down, it's like also you had no limitations, like, oh well, I'm going to be in this venue, it's small, and the piece will be that size, or, you know, so you could just go, no, I'm gonna take, you know, 50 meter fabric and drag it behind me, and it's gonna blow in the wind, you know, and all of these kind of, and it's gonna be orange, and then it's gonna turn yellow, and without
one,
any reality.
One ticket to that, please.
you didn't have the lovely time where you're talking to a production manager going, how are we going to do that? You know, what's the practicality? You didn't have to link in to the practicalities.
Yeah.
Of
because of the inability to, you know, to rent a studio and rehearse and dance, I found myself actually here at IMA at the People's Pavilion. There was a big open space and I was practicing every day. And it just suddenly, you know, people would come and they could sit and watch, you know, while I was kind of gyrating on the floor. And I remember this, it was very interesting because suddenly being watched as you rehearse, you know, it kind of became a performance, but it wasn't. And I remember one day this father came and sat really close to me with his kid. And the kid said, what's wrong with him? And the father said, oh, I think he's a contemporary dancer. And he said, but you know, I much prefer Childish Gambino. And well, I was
kind of like on the basis of one
I'm going to kill him. No, this is it's all about this new relationship. Philip, use it, bring it out. Relationship. It was interesting.
I keep on thinking that the pandemic has just brought forward more of the problems that we already have. So like underfunding or like under supports or the hardships that already exist in the industries, the creative industry in Ireland. How have you felt it? Or do you feel like that weight is there more? Or that, like, definitely there was the whole campaign of Save the Arts and we were trying to push all that. What do you think, or what's your?
Yeah, I've got to counter that a little bit because I think we live in a time of huge optimism for the arts. Actually, I think there's a huge opportunity ahead of us. Mm-hmm. One is that organisations like Campaign for the Arts just did a huge amount of advocacy on behalf of us all, and it worked with government. And so, you know, funding is higher than it has been for a long time. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've got a minister right now who understands the arts. We're talking about piloting a scheme of universal basic income for artists, you know, something that we probably didn't think was in reach, and should say, you know, it should not be exclusive to artists. We should have a universal basic income for everybody. And so I do think that we live in a time of huge optimism. I think if we don't psychically acknowledge that, we'll wallow in the other kind of the things that we don't have.
Yeah.
But actually, I think for what I've really appreciated about the pandemic, and Amanda kind of hit the nail on the head about the kind of the idea of rest, is that actually the kind of, I think for artists, for everyone, I don't know, we work in the arts, so, you know, but for everybody, is that like the hamster wheel got stopped, right? So a lot of us live in a constant cycle of production, idea, how are we going to get the thing up, apply for funding, generate an audience, and the wheel goes on and on. And you never have that dream space, this abstract time. And I think that, so for, that hamster wheel for me got stopped and it allowed a lot of things to come in. It was terrifying. It was not always a happy place, but like a lot of good things happened out of it. And then I think within our industry, a lot of people woke up to some broken and toxic systems. And I think that also audiences, wider society, people in the halls of power realized on some level, you know, not to extremes always, but like the value of art in society. Mm. Suddenly it was all we had for a moment. Mm. So I think there's like huge positives, and I think it's, you know, it's not always our job, but it's part of our job to kind of continue that story. Mm. One thing that I don't like having to do is like when you say you're an artist or you work in the arts or whatever, is to constantly have to justify that, to say, and also, this is why, you know, to be front-facing and say, and this is why the government should be supporting art. Well, it's there, you know. Mm. But I do think, like, look, the hamster wheel was stopped. It may be stopped again. And it's just like, so now we've got to dream about the next part.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you find yourself starting a project? Is it from engaging with a partner? Is it by yourself with a pen? Is it going for a walk? And then getting to a point that you're like, oh yeah, this is something I'm going to ride with and go with.
I think it stems back from the hangover of being a stand-up, a recovering stand-up comic, in that this is my 10th year since giving up stand-up comedy, but I've continued to write all the time. And little nuggets that were on napkins or at the back of my hand, or just it starts with a word or a phrase that I remember back in the day when I couldn't wait to get off stage from stand-up, that I knew I could never say that, but I could put those words into the mouth of a character and they could say it. And so I always wanted to kind of hurry up, and it was kind of, it was like a mistress I was trying to break up with for a long while, that I said after year 10, I would give up stand-up, and it took me 5 more years to eventually get away from it. To channel the storytelling ability in different means, be it writing for animation or writing for kids shows or writing drama for TV, or playing a different role as characters as well. So it starts with a word or a phrase that I might overhear. And I think it goes back to, again, I've had two different lives. When I was an accountant, I always thought of short, medium, and long-term projects. And I think I've kept with those to this day, in that I'm thinking of something that I'll do in 2025 that I need to start getting busy on that now. I know there's something quite immediate that I need to do. Like Philip was saying earlier about looking for funding. How am I going to pay mortgage in the next few months or so? If I did that project there, that would pay me and that would roll me over to the next thing. And then the short-term thing is, what can I get done in 22, 23? Like, so I'm kind of still using that way of me working, and it's how I work best.
And that, you're so organised.
Oh. Well, inside the head, there's the...
I think we're all going, yeah, please organise my life.
Yeah, brilliant.
I'm good for others, not for my own self. Like, you know, I talk a good talk, but like when it comes to doing, like I wake up in a panic every day.
Yeah,
every
but that's day, what I was going to say, time. Is what people want to hear who are watching this or listening to this, is like your experiences of what Paddy just said, is that people see, oh, there's whoever, say Amanda Coogan doing a big show in Rural Red. What was it like to create that process? And it doesn't come like this just because you've been doing or you've done big shows. It's still, you're still that, I presume, same person of like, oh yeah, I have to develop the idea, I have to come up with the idea, I have to work with my collaborators, that journey. Do you want to talk about it for a second?
Well, I mean, I think the journey is exciting. That's why we do it, I assume. Yeah. Kind of biting into an idea and doing the dreaming of it. What could it be? How could it, you know, and doing, I adore researching as well, but I'm a very undisciplined researcher. It's like, I'll read something, I go, and that's it, I don't read anymore. I've just seen some beautiful little nugget there that I run with, and I can knit that in conceptually into my head. So I love all that process. And actually, a very brilliant Canadian artist said to me a couple of years ago, panic is part of the process. And it was almost like, oh, thank God, I've just been given permission not to panic because I'm so panicked. But I kind of like the adrenaline fuel of having to complete, you know, having a deadline and having to complete something. Because in all fairness, you can be in your studio forever making these lovely little noodles. But I do, you learn so much when you put it in public. Mm. And actually, I learn so much when I'm live as well. So my practice is as a visual artist, but I treat the body as a sculpture. So liveness and living installation, if we call it that within a visual arts way, is actually, and I like to do it for very long periods of time, and I just learn so much, and I find that feeds into the next piece as well. So all of those things, yeah, they're really hard, but you learn so much, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah, what about you, Una, and how you deal with that process of coming up with something, and is it always a response to something, or...?
Yeah, maybe it is, or seeing patterns, or making connections between different things, or actually just like thinking about something for ages and ages, maybe even years, until you reach the simplicity of it and go, oh, actually it's just this really, really simple thing now, and that's what something is going to be about.
And how do you juggle that, or how do you juggle what you're going to focus on?
like badly, obviously, dropping everything. I think, you know, somebody said, which I've heard before, but it just kind of landed with me recently, and I really resent this statement being brought back into my life because I think it is true, and it's that in order to make interesting work, you have to live a boring life. When you're actually doing it, when you're working, when you're properly working on it, and, you know, that's something that I've really struggled with, you know, for the last decade, you know, just running around the place and trying to, like, juice life to the max, and, you know, that's great and everything, but you do end up burning yourself out, and then you can't do anything. So, yeah, I think, like, I don't know, I think all of my... the thoughts about this kind of stuff are kind of boring because they're actually quite practical. Like, if I could live in the dreamy part of things forever, I would just do that. But, like, I think finishing stuff is key.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people, like, I know I do this. Like, I pick up something, it's super juicy. I'm like, oh, my God, this is a thing. And I, like, can really feel the idea almost like a second skin, like I can feel the whole thing, and I'm like, this is the thing. And then once I start to walk around in it, of course, bits just like start falling off, and I'm like, oh my God, this is an absolute crock. It's like disintegrating in front of me, and the more I go into it, I'm like, disintegrate, everything's a complete mess. And then one day it's like, oh, actually no, this has kind of morphed into something else. My problem is, again, I'm not answering your question, I'm just like randomly talking, but my problem is I get some idea, and that is, you know, just in my mind, brilliant. And this is the thing. And then I'm like, blah, blah, blah. And then, unfortunately, like, you know, a few months later, another, like, sexy little idea walks in and goes, what about me? I'm a cool thing. And that's what I find hard. Too much stuff and trying to, like, plow the furrow that you finish something. Because the thing is, any creative person, any artist, any person who thinks deeply about shit, you know, ideas are 10 a fucking penny. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can just be like, that sounds cool, that'd be a cool vibe, yeah. That's a little thing, oh, that's like, you know, a conflict that would make a juicy thing, la la la. But like, it's the doing and the finishing. Mm. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of talk about, I don't know, sometimes I find that like everybody who does work seriously knows that it's about, you know, craft and graft and the discipline and the dedication is what separates, you know, people who talk shit to people who actually get shit done.
Yeah, exactly. And I think everything you just said, and I'll ask your opinion now, guys, what that is, highlights the process for a lot of people and what sometimes everything you just said there isn't said enough, and that people don't understand this is the processes behind people, mm. or that you do need to do the hard grind to get whatever it is, or that that person hasn't just been handed that show in project or whatever, or they have worked their ass off, or they have done many different things and they continue to work. And I think there's a misconception of, like, even when you get to a certain point that it's easy for you to do the next thing, mm. and it's not. There's many other hurdles. And like what I was saying before is that you could be in a really great place and being off the project, but that doesn't mean your personal life isn't falling apart, or your mum just has died and you're dealing with something. So it's like those personal triggers can completely affect who you are and what you are, or like your friends, or you're fighting with a friend or a partner. It's all those things that are around it and people don't speak enough about. And it's the emerging artists who need to hear this stuff. Like, this is actually the reality. It's like, this is the reality of trying to get somewhere. And what do you think about
it? Well, I'd say most of that ends up in the work.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm not working with text, and it's mm-hmm. probably a little more abstract. And,
yeah.
Maybe there's more play with that. I have definitely a lot of anxiety just before beginning something, you know, because mm-hmm. you have this idea, like Una said, you know, like you have this idea and you think, oh, this will be a really good idea. And then as you get closer, you're like, oh, God, now I'm going to have to do it. And then it morphs into something completely different. So with all of those insecurities, there's also, you have to kind of also constantly trust in yourself
And for me, it's a real, why I do it again and again is because it's a really interesting learning process. It's a way of gaining a depth using the discipline of going in every day and stopping everything else and working on this. It's gaining a depth of knowledge from a very personal perspective, you know. But it's my way of discovering things about myself and about what I'm working on, and also seeing how it just morphs into something completely different. I think one of the things I've realized over the years is quite often I think I'm making something, and retrospectively it's something totally different. And that's fine. That's actually fine. In fact, it's quite interesting.
It's better.
You kind of go, oh shit, that's what it was about.
Yeah. And then the same way, like what you were saying, Una, as well, that all these ideas that come to you, and I'm only learning this, or I've said the words loudly to myself in the last 3 or 4 years, you don't have to act on every single idea. Hmm. And I almost high-five myself to go, at least I came up with that idea, like ruminate on it for a while, and it might come into another project down the road somewhere else, or offer to somebody else in a way that, like, I get to a stage of being paralytic with, like, all these things are bumping into each other, and I don't know what to do, where do I put each one of them? And it's just how I work, but I love having the ideas. I love, as creatives, then, and talking to other people with these ideas, but then it's okay to say goodbye to that one.
Sometimes you need to kill your babies. It's not ready for, and how I can do it is, it's not ready for this project, I'll just leave it there for the minute, and it's okay. And it might, 3 or 4 years later, come in, and it's like, oh yeah, remember that one.
Because you get wrapped up in knots trying to finish that off, and it's not ready to be finished. We're not in a world where they're ready for that just yet, so kind of
shape it, and it's through that graft, like you were talking about.
My favourite thing is when, like, writers and stuff, particularly writers of books, say things like, oh, you know, it took me like 16, 17 years. I'm like, perfect.
Thank you.
Music to my ears.
But we need to hear more of those people. Like, you know, just like this
overnight
success.
There's a lot of like, it just came out of me in 2 months, was there. I'm like, fuck.
But I think it's worth, you know, I think for younger artists, it's like the things that to demystify is that, like, we're all making up the process every single time we do a project.
Totally.
There is no set, you know, book of rules or whatever, and it is torture every time. It's absolute torture. However, it's a charmed life. Like, the reason we continue to do it is because we live this fabulous life outside of the margins. So when we say it's torture for somebody living a charmed existence. Do you know what I mean? It's like a Kardashian saying they can't get, like, I don't know, their car valeted or something like that. But do you know what I mean? We do have to remember that, like, the reason that we stay in this, well, for lots of us, you know, there's nothing else that we can do, let's be honest. But there's something very attractive about, like, just living slightly off the received grid and discovering all of these people along the way. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of find your, I guess, you know, finding your tribe is very important to making the work that you want to make. And it does get easier, but the challenges change because you've got to stay relevant. But you've got to, like, so, but, like, you know a lot more, and you know a lot more people, and you know a lot more of the avenues in which you can. If I call Philip, you know, he might know of some funding funding is the thing that, you know, is ultimately what you know, and Ireland relative to other places is kind of good for that, actually. But, like, to kind of sustainable career is about how you're going to fund that career.
But it's also, say you fight for that funding for so many years of your life, then you get the funding, then you're like, shit, now I need to do something good with that funding. And you have that guilt of all those ideas of, like, is this the project that I'm definitely working with? Are they those people that you do find yourself maybe working with the same people, or a certain crew or a certain artist, because there's so much pressure on it, and you don't have an endless pit of money to go, oh yeah, this is going to work.
I've got no sympathy for the funding woes from artists. None. It's like, you've got the funding, do the thing, and then do it again. Like, make something fabulous that people want to see. And let's keep it rocking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is there a bridge for younger artists then? From the, because I, again, as an accountant, give me the forms. Love them. I find that as another way of just dealing with. But then people
I'm calling you out.
to a point where that people want to create, but they don't want to admin. And so I think there's a huge gap in that world. Yeah. And I think we create a czar for funding in order to help the young artists in order to bridge that gap and let me go and create, but where do I get the funding? I don't want to waste my time on that. No, I call it waste of time. You have to waste your time doing it.
Yeah, I think to pick up on that, and sorry if I'm talking too much, I think that we all, I've kind of praised our systems in some way, but to kind of counter my own argument is that we do live in a society that has infantilized artists, and we live in a system that has kept artists semi-professional, which feeds into you've got to be the person that applies for the funding, you've got to have the idea, you've got to get the idea going, you've got to employ the people, you've got to square your tax, and you've paid all of those people, and you've got to square the tax, and then the government don't look at you as an employer, but they also don't look at you as self-employed. And so it's red tape and red tape and red tape. And so that's a massive thing that we can sort out, like that can be sorted out. But I think artists we've been kept semi-professional or just below that, I would say.
I think from a visual arts perspective, if I can just talk about that, actually, I haven't heard it articulated in that way, but often, young visual artists think that they've failed if they have to have a part-time job, and that's not the case. It's like you try and box clever when you're trying to make your name and have a part-time job that will take the least amount of your time and pay the most amount of money so that you can be in the studio making the stuff.
It really is. Or whatever doesn't take up your mind space enough.
It's really tricky to find that. Really, really tricky to find that, whatever way it works. But it doesn't mean that you're a bad artist because you can't live off art. I think it's really important.
What I always say to people is
everyone. Is that wrong to kind of.
No, not at all.
Do you know
I would champion
mean?
That from the rooftops. Yeah. Sometimes I fear that is the next generation, is there that sense of entitlement? I can't believe I'm saying this again, but. That they can only do that one thing. You can't.
No, I don't think that's
like, you know, in that, like, so you go and work in the restaurant, go and work in the bar, and then do your...
I don't think that's a thing. I think people do all that stuff. I don't think there's a generational split around entitlement or anything like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would only say that I did my master's, for example, with a really important visual artist who was in all the history books, Marina Abramovich, and she was teaching every month. Like, boom. So there's no shame in it.
Yeah.
Everyone's journey is, again, slightly cliched. Everyone's journey is different. And I used an example of an artist that had a full-time job, has children, but just absolutely nailed her practice. And she went in, made work, obviously found time to go into studio at some point, wasn't in studio a lot, but managed to get in a show maybe once or twice a year and was happy with that. It's what is your target? Everyone's target's different. And you need to not compare yourself to that. And I see, because I deal with a lot of emerging artists as well, and trying to find that out. What is your target? Because you can't compare yourself. The minute you start comparing yourself with other people and other people's journeys, you're doomed. Because this girl was a really good example of like, Jesus, she was fucking nailing her career. And I'm like, she is literally spending maybe 2, 3 days, 4 days in the studio, maybe a month, I'm guessing. And she just knows how to work her practice right, and is really happy in being that artist and knows, okay, I'm never going to be Damien Hirst or whoever, and like I'm going to focus on this. And having that target in your life allows you to escape all those problems that kind of are thrown at you. And I think as you get older, you do become more acceptive of that. Well, I think so.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever gone, oh, I want to be at that level and that's enough for me. I don't know if that
but
makes
I do.
Sense for me.
Yeah, I know. I've met people who I'm like, well, have you thought about where you want to go? Because, for instance, like especially in the arts, you probably have to leave Ireland and go to London, go to Europe, maybe go to America if you want to be massive.
I don't know. I disagree with that.
Go on.
I think it's more about fulfilling your but in terms of success, let's say, I think it's fulfilling. You know, your own ideas, like fulfilling them to the best of your ability, like not thinking about an industry, not thinking about metrics of success or where to show or blah blah blah. You know, it's like that Beckett thing. You know, a story takes as long is as long as it takes to fulfill itself. You know, so and with regards to going away and things like that, like sure, people can do that, but like. You can, you know, you can fulfill. You can be very fulfilled and successful internationally and be staying in Ireland.
Oh yeah, no, I know. What I'll actually kind of continue because I agree what you're saying. It's what I'm saying. What I always say to people as well is finding your happiness because everyone's happiness is totally different. Some people might be very very happy showing in the middle of Ireland, west of Ireland, for their whole life and don't give a shit about going to Berlin. And be far happier than someone who's chasing a dream of being in some show in MoMA or somewhere in anywhere. That for me, and what I always say to people is like, find that journey of what you want to be and make sure you're looking for where you're going to be happy. Because at the end of the day, I think your happiness is the most important
thing. I get that's the difference between career and practice.
Yeah.
Like there's quite disparate things, you know, when career interacts with the creative thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of shit gets fucked up for people themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you start comparing yourself to people. I should be here. This is my plan. La, 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 la. All that. I'm speaking for myself. That's all a little bollocks.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Have a good time. Try and make amazing work. Hang out with great people. Take risks and push yourself. The other shit, it doesn't fucking matter.
That's great advice. I wanted to ask, I suppose, those of you who maybe who have worked abroad compared to, and in Ireland, and what your experiences have been in that, just in like how you managed to do that, even in a simple case of people watching this want to know, how do you break into, I want to show, do a show in London or Europe or America? Or...
How do you do that? Would you let me know?
Will you tell me?
Yeah, we'll let me know. I mean, I think in the visual arts world, which is slightly different, I think, to theatre and literature and filmmaking and dance, of course, well, we're a bit similar. I think we're like first cousins, right?
I agree.
I studied abroad, so I started exhibiting in Germany after I studied there straight away, and you do get invitations. I don't understand how to hustle abroad. I don't. I'm sorry for using that word, but there is a whole moment of hustle as well. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, pieces of work or exhibitions or live performances are generative, both in ideas and then with people seeing your work sometimes and inviting you to something else or your, I think that also it's very easy as a solo art. Like I flip between being a solo artist, so I can literally pack a suitcase and go, I'm here, and it's cheap. Or I'm here and here's my crowd, and we have, you know, then it's a whole other baby. So it's getting into those things. Mm. And I meet some very nice people, I get invitations.
And I suppose maybe even like what happens while you're there is that you build your network then, and that helps you maybe to go back to that location or that they're working in a different... I'm just thinking about Los Angeles. Obviously, you built that little family of dancers and suddenly you have this new artistic family that you're working with. And
The idea of networking makes me want to vomit because it frightens the shit out of me. And I have to say, because I... sometimes... And because I'm live artist and I kind of would be very present in the moment that in the theatre world we might call improvising... through a long durational piece. I don't like the term. So I'm on, I'm down the tunnels, as you say, with the Wi-Fi off and really concentrating. Mm. So I find it very difficult when I'm live and exhibiting to do the classic networking. So what I need is a curator who does that and whispers in my ear, like, Grant, I'll talk to them now in a minute. I'll do this thing, rolling around the floor with my group of dancers in Los Angeles, as we did in C Club.
And Philly, how about you? What What's your experience of working abroad and making that happen?
Well, with This Is Pop Baby, we've toured extensively abroad, really. Australia mainly, and the UK and the US some as well. And I think, you know, if I was trying to explain the process to somebody who was kind of starting out, you know, I think the main thing is to be, in order to be brilliant abroad, you've got to be brilliant at what you do at home, right? And that's not saying the work that we make is brilliant, although it is. But that, you know, it's about standby for clanger word, authenticity at home. You know, you make something that is so completely you or your group or your, you know, I work in theatre and I kind of work in two strands of theatre. And one is kind of event theatre with This Is Pop Baby. And then I also write plays, which kind of, I'm very jealous of these two often because of the, you know, the abstraction of the mind, but like, because I can be quite narrative focused. And so for narrative things, you know, and in Ireland, we've got an amazing, you know, literary heritage. And for our theatre, really, you can only go to English-speaking countries because in a European theatre, A, there are too many words in our plays, and B, they're all in English. Mm-hmm. But we found kind of great networks in Australia, and we've toured Panty across Australia a number of times, and we've toured Riot across Australia and the US and Canada, and brought work to the UK as well. But I always think that... you know, there's a couple of ways that happens, and one is you start to build a network. Somebody will visit a festival here, and you'll get on really well with them, or you go for a coffee with them or whatever, and then you'll let them know about your next show. Or somebody out of the blue will see your work online and will invite you somewhere. But it's always worth thinking about, like, look, where does this work actually sit? Mm. You know, because I'm not going to go, well, I think my work sits in Oslo and on Broadway, so how do I make those things happen? It's about being focused and kind of going, I know from whether it's you've traveled or you've seen stuff online, I know, for instance, you know, my work would sit really nicely in Soho Theatre. Well, why don't I make that an objective? Ask to meet somebody when I go there or ask somebody to Zoom or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we live in an age now where technology has broken down so many barriers, including what the pandemic has done is that people in London or in Sydney, they no longer say to you, oh, well, next time you're in town, give us a shout. They're like, oh, can you Zoom for 30 minutes or whatever?
Yeah.
So you can reach out to people, and that doesn't always work. But, you know, in my experience, it has worked quite a bit.
Yeah, I've always said to people that you'd be very surprised, and maybe my experience in Ireland hasn't been this, but in America especially, how receptive people are to have a phone call or a coffee, and in England as well. And I always give the advice of don't ask someone for something, just ask them for a cup of coffee and just talk to them. And so many times people reply and you're like, Jesus Christ, they're this massive production designer and they've just fucking emailed me back. I'm like, oh my God, now I'm actually going to meet them. And we need to do that more, I think, in Ireland, that not feel like those walls are up, and because like this, that people are usually there for each other and that we all want the same thing. We're all fighting for culture and trying to promote culture and be, we're all part of this family and have chosen these paths. So there's no one against each other, but sometimes the funding obviously starts pitting people against each other, and that can be quite disheartening. Mm-hmm. But it's trying to ignore all that and then trying to reach out to people and build, and I suppose maybe widen your own network and widen your own family. But it's the networking and the motherload of all the stuff that you have to juggle.
I also think that an interesting way to kind of expand those international relationships is through collaboration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, making work with other artists from different countries, collaborating together, was a very organic introduction into that particular art scene in that particular place, as opposed to kind of appearing out of the blue and going, hi, I'm from Ireland, would you like to present my work? You know, and quite often, actually, when that has been the case, it's... Unless there's some kind of radical in the area of dance, at least.
Yeah.
I don't know about other areas, but like unless there's some radical Irishism that would kind of make it curatorially valid to have this random Irish company suddenly there, then it's kind of difficult. So actually, by presenting work in that country on their terms, without the Irish kind of weight, it was a much easier way to kind of develop relationships and an organic way to kind of, not network, but have your work seen and, you know, meet people and I think that's a very interesting thing. Again, with dance and visual arts, it's probably easier because language is less of a barrier.
Yeah. And that when we get on the floor almost with collaborators from Spain, Germany, you know, whatever, that is just a brilliant bond as well because we're meeting each other as artists. Mm. So you do through the work rather than in other.
Yeah.
Ways, I think.
Yeah. I think sometimes we don't acknowledge enough that we're an island and that there's other parts of Europe. Obviously, it's a lot easier to have the intermingling of different cultures and dynamics. And obviously, we all fly everywhere, we used to, and that's helped things. But that we are this island nation and that we've, like all countries, have gone through our own historical issues. But just to bring it back for a second, and Paddy, I was going to ask you this, what do you think has changed in the last decade or two in Ireland, in I suppose positively and negatively, in the arts?
Well, I can only speak from myself in that I think there's a confidence has come into the arts in Ireland, and I think we're kind of walking a little bit taller and chest is out a bit more, and that we can travel, and we have travelled with our work, in so far as that I speak personally then of a bit of hustle that you talked about earlier on, in that I spent 15 years being a stand-up, and there was good and bad about that, and the bad was I had trained as an actor, but I was never getting seen for parts because I was always the funny guy, and so you'd walk into a room and naturally they smile and go, here's the funny guy, and go, fuck it. I've trained up, I can do this. And I wasn't getting seen. And I decided to go to... I was a fan of the TV show Shameless. And I said, there's a lot of Irish characters on that. I'm going to get into Shameless. But I had no idea how. I didn't have an agent at the time. I don't have an agent. And I said, I just looked up the name of the casting agent and said, casting director, David Shaw. And I rang him one day and said, I would love to be seen. And so it was before the advent of self-tapes, which I fucking love self-tapes, by the way, because by the time it goes across to them, it's take 17, but they just see it once. But
I've never heard an actor say they love self-tapes. I'm so intrigued.
Oh, man, I just...
Wow,
yeah.
I thought self-tapes were like... Because we love self-tapes because it can happen so quickly. Mm. But I thought actors hate them.
At the moment, the reason I love self-tapes is I'm 6 for 6 with self-tapes. I'm just going, I'm shitting for the next one then. I go, fuck, that's going to be the one I'm not going to get. But back then, David Shaw said, well, are you ringing from London? The casting director, he's in Manchester. I said, I'm not in London. He said, but most Irish actors move to London. I go, but I don't want to. I'm Paddy from Ireland. Can you not hire me out of Ireland? And it came out of me without realising. I said, I can get to you in Manchester quicker than an actor from London. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, we'll chat. Hung up the phone. The next day he rang, can you be here tomorrow? And like Michael O'Leary and Ryanair got me there the next day, the following Friday, and we read and we read and we read, and I got the part in Shameless. And then as a result, Manchester is where I've done most of my acting work. Mm. Because I never once on the phone said I'm a stand-up comic. I just said, I'm an actor from Dublin who wants to work. Mm. Can you help me work? Mm. And so the hustle works in some ways. And just to go after it, because I knew if I stayed here... Now, I want to stay here. I'm Paddy Irishman. I love being from Dublin. I love being Irish, and I love being based here. Mm. But I didn't want to have to move to there to kind of start all over again. Like, so yeah. I think it was the start of that confidence thing, but I go back to again, that to have the confidence... Now, I was shitting myself to kind of go, oh, I've got to lay it all bare over here. And then I went over to him and said, by the way, I'm shit at accents. So will you make the character, if there is a character, from Dublin, please? And we've stayed pals ever since, and he still rings me for...
You're very fussy, aren't you?
I'm very limited.
Where's Joe Blair?
Who's asking?
We're asking.
Who's we?
Us six in here. Me, him, her, and them three in the back.
Who's you six in there? You, him, her, them three in the back?
Paddy, does it matter? Where's Joe Blair's trailer, man? We need to have a word with him.
Really?
It's a crack,
buddy. So I think what you're saying there raises something really interesting about like how people are perceived at like in their home country and how they're then perceived elsewhere, and like there is a kind of, I don't know, there's typecasting and then there's like Ireland casting or something. Yeah. And like, you know, I think when people are struggling maybe to cut through or to reimagine themselves or like sidestep into something else in this country or in any country where anybody is from, like often you know, international work or doing something elsewhere, like, can feel really intimidating, and how do you even start that? But actually, sometimes it can be easier than doing something that you want here. Like, I mean, I've certainly found that with my more kind of creative writing work, like, there's much bigger appetite for that work that I do outside of Ireland than there is in Ireland. That I've found that, you know, and that's really, it's really interesting, you know, because...
It's kind of upsetting too, though. Well, I find it personally upsetting. Yeah. That it's kind of really, I'm more the sum of the parts that you think I am.
Yeah, but I think it's like, you know, there's a conservatism that demands familiarity from a lot of creative industries in Ireland. And, you know, you could go on a whole thesis about why that is, about, like, you know, how we decide people are who we say they are and things like that. But that means that, like, yes, it can be difficult to, like, you know, turn up and be like, now I'm this here. And that can, you can feel like gaslit, that your, you know, your desires aren't being listened to, blah, 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 work it out with your therapist, whatever. But outside of then where you're from, you know, can provide like a more blank slate, and you're seen actually kind of for your ideas and your talent, as opposed to things that you think may help you in your home country, like profile or familiarity or network. You know, sometimes they can actually be stifling forces as well.
Or justification of your work through somebody else's work or something
yeah,
that came
totally,
before.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to just, as you said, blank slate and kind of going, well, it's this.
This is me now.
This is
yeah,
me now.
And like the interest can be very authentic, actually, because people are gravitating towards somebody that they don't know, but they're interested in their work, whatever. Mm-hmm.
I guess it is another... It is also something that's acquired and something that's learned, and it's not nothing's new or a total clean slate. But, you know, seeing theatre in or dance, you know, abstract dance in France or Germany, I don't feel that it has to be justified mm-hmm. through mm-hmm. Lederhosen or yeah. you know or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I think God, we really have that pressure on us a lot to have to kind of make something through something else or justify what we're doing because it's in relation to.
You mean in terms of national identity?
Yes.
Yeah.
But also like living abroad for 20 years, you know, to counter as you said, to counter that. What I just said, living abroad for 20 years, I always felt at the same time that when I was making something or when I was performing or the way I, the type of presence or the energy I decided to have on stage, I had to constantly alter it. And it felt artificial and it felt wrong.
Tell me more about that.
So I just mean, like, for example, If you look at your range of emotions or your range of how you want to register performatively, you know, where you want to register, mm-hmm. just energetically, how much you want to give, I always felt that it was too much everywhere else. And when I moved back to Dublin and started working here as an artist and continued to create here as an artist, I suddenly felt it was understood.
Right.
So the decisions I was making, I didn't have to kind of over-explain them, and that was lovely, and that was like a relaxation and a
right,
breath of fresh air.
Because you're like artist, your language of movement is actually understood in the place where it has emerged.
Yes,
from.
Exactly. Whereas it might have been considered slightly shoddy or under rehearsed or not clean enough or a mistake or not completely defined. And I was like, no, this is the way it's supposed to be. And so, you know, so there is that other side here, which is really lovely. I think that was a really positive thing.
But I think we lack the language around that sometimes. Because, like, if you look at, like, you know, Japanese aesthetic philosophy or whatever, there's all these, like, entire suites of language around like kintsugi and wabi-sabi and beauty and brokenness and like shadows and darkness and how things need to be a little bit off and that's the aesthetic and blah blah blah, and I think we lack some of that language in Ireland to demonstrate why our particular visual language and artistic language, creative language, is how it is. I'm not saying that we should like intellectualize everything, but
no, but it is still heavily subconscious.
Yeah, and then we're like, we're shit because of colonialism.
Yeah.
I suppose what I wanted to move on to talk about was thinking about our place in Ireland and where we see Irish culture going and what we're really excited about, but also the hardships.
Well, I don't really know how to answer that, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. All I can say is that I did, Northern Philip, I worked abroad, like you lived abroad for years.
Yes.
And I felt I needed to, I felt my work always came from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I needed to come home. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say. I don't know what,
good.
I can't tell you the flavour of why it is. I don't really want to identify that, but I need to be rooted here.
Maybe I'll phrase the question a different way. And again, this is a 5-minute conversation about what I'm about to say. Is obviously a lot of venues have been closing over the years in Ireland. We had the recession, and then we came out of the recession. Places closed. Some people survived. Culture is constantly being fought for. Then we had like Save the Arts campaign, and there was always this thing of fighting for the arts. And it's trying to find your place within that. And that's, it's for us, I'll say myself, is where do I see myself in that? Is, I suppose, just trying to keep on making things and hoping for the better. And is it you're just doing it anyway, no matter what? Because it's like, oh, yeah, I've chosen this path. Does that make sense? Billy, what do you think?
It does make sense. But for me, I guess we think about, look, well, what's my practice or where is that going?
Affecting me or whatever.
But what I've become interested in, and it feeds into what is the future for Irish arts, is just the generational shift or the releasing of baggage, I would say, that I see in young artists. Mm-hmm. And I think for, different ages here, but our generation or generations, we still, have carried that kind of shame and guilt and the sins and history of the past in a way. And I see in young people that a lot of them are free from that. Mm-hmm. And it is so amazing to watch, and it means that their ideas are things that you, for a start, they don't reference Ireland, their ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think certainly in the theatre that we are constantly in this kind of loop of talking about Ireland, really trying to excavate and discover who we are and what is my place in this kind of place that has kind of a tortured history. And young people are free of that.
Yeah.
And is this connected? I don't know, but I'm going to say before we finish, I'm kind of loving the TikTokification of Ireland at the moment. And a stone's throw from here outside the Hilton in Kilmainham, a few weeks ago, I saw these three, 15-year-old boys in tracksuits, and they're placing a phone down. I kind of go, what's going on here? And then one of them presses play on a ghetto blaster. And they start doing this very simple but effective, dance, mm-hmm. the three of them. And I kind of thought, we never would have been that free as kids.
Yeah.
Three boys,
yeah.
I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say three working class boys dancing on the street. And I kind of think, well, actually, there's a generation of people that are free from the shit that I grew up with.
Mm. I actually saw you passing. That was me.
It must have been good lighting for you. Looking through.
Yeah. It was a dark alleyway.
Paddy, what do you think of all this?
I just love the word TikTokification. Yeah. I'm nicking that. That's gorgeous.
It's yours.
And it is, though. And do you know, without being like, I've paused and looked at kids doing this, and we no longer have to talk about the famine. We no longer have to talk about the oppression. I don't think we should ever forget it. And people of our generation, we talk about that, will have that. But I keep going back to it. There is this confidence. Like, we'd never, like those three lads 20 years ago would have boxed the head off each other rather than set up the phone on the wall and dance to these moves. So I think that, not that we're being taken seriously, because I never want to be taken seriously. The reason I do this is for the funny. I always wake up in the morning, where's find the funny?
Yeah.
That's my rule.
I suppose what's hard as well is sometimes, because we think about they don't have any of this baggage, but then when it's thrown back at you, potentially in certain areas of the world where they do still see leprechauns and shamrocks, and that is still very active, and that can be really hard and disarming, and you're like, oh yeah, I have to fight against that stereotype now. And like, it's great that people aren't, or just jumping ahead of that and jumping over that. But for us, it's been a hurdle that sometimes we have to jump over.
Mm. I think, though, that, the things that you know, the positive thing is, like, we're in a golden age of Irish creativity right now, and it's rooted in the construction, the organic construction of a new Irish identity. And it's not represented around this table, but, like, the most exciting thing about, you know, art, emerging art or whatever, is the result of immigration in Ireland, and particularly young Afro-Irish people who are the youth culture now, like the mainstream youth culture, and certainly like where the majority of really, really interesting music is being made.
Yeah.
And how that idea of Ireland and that identity is being constructed, and that is you know, that is the dominant political force of the next decade, you know, because culture moves politics, so you're just seeing all these kind of things around this, like, new patriotism that is non-sectarian and non-problematic and non-oppressive and shedding certain things that were very Irish, you know, like imposed shame, which is actually just colonialist guilt or whatever, or the guilt of colonizers, rather, but taking all of the other bits, like the aesthetic, like the contemporary Irish aesthetic is Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, across apparel, across graphic design, across, you know, rap videos. I mean, this is really seismic, right? Because these are the things that our generation were told were lame, embarrassing, blah, blah, blah. There is no sense of embarrassment or lameness about the Irish language for this generation. In fact, you know, you have just people constantly talking about Manco McGann's book, 32 Words for Field, and how it connects us with the land and these emotions and this spiritual realm that we didn't know. Ah, it's so crazy. Why didn't you take it away from us? So, like, this entire wheel, you know, from our own calendar, you know, that is turning right now is bringing us into this very, you know, beautifully hedonistic, Celtic, island mentality that is unburdened by theocracy and is actually re-emerging into something that is truly about embracing our place in the world, really. Not our place in the world sold back to us by the Irish-American diaspora, not our place told to us by the collaboration between church and state, which obviously was a load of fucking bollocks that we're still trying to untangle, but this other thing. And it, like, it's just so fucking exciting.
Yeah.
You know, and the art that's coming out of that, and the ways of the stance, you know, the actual way that people are moving through the streets and through the world is absolutely amazing. And that is going to change this country in profound ways.
Mm.
Even the physical makeup of the country and where borders will now would dissipate and all that kind of stuff. Everything is going to change in the next few years in Ireland. We are going to be a radically different place in the next decade and a half, maybe even a new country entirely.
Yeah, I think, well said. I think all the platforms, like we were talking about social media, is allowing these new artists to actually get exposure. And that, like, every time I see someone and we're like, or I'm talking to Kira, I'm like, oh my God, we need to, is there any way we can help this person's career? Like, is there anything we can do? Or can other people do it? Or I'm like, Arts Council needs to throw money at these people. Or, like, people need to give them airtime. And it's so great when I see people collaborating together and people helping new generations to get a leg up and get seen and get heard.
Yeah, I mean, it's about emergence, though. Like, I could go on for ages about, like, top-down stuff, but it is about emergence, which is why that we need, you know, the best thing that we could do for the arts is, you know, rent control and get out these stupid neoliberal political forces from our society. Goodbye.
Yeah.
And like, because the emergence in the underground needs to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, culture is an ecosystem, and funding and top-down and people who've made it and all that, absolutely fantastic, but it comes from the underground.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make the underground hard to exist, you fuck everything. Mm-hmm. This is an ecosystem that we're talking about that exists in habitats of urban places. So we need to get back to what can we do as a society to make dangerous, fringe, avant-garde, unwatchable, wild, banana town art happen. And the people who make that art, who may not be best at business or getting jobs or whatever, be able to live in a place where they can create it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. And that's the...
No, the answer is very clear. You get rid of the political forces that are stifling. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose, like, without being too disheartening, and we'll move on to a positive thing, is that...
I want a whoop.
No, I'm being positive. I'm saying what I'm about to say is negative.
Oh.
Is that...
think fast.
Unfortunately, everyone thinks like that, and that's the fucking problem.
No, that's completely
just
wrong.
Just hold on, let me say my sentence. That I distinctly remember a conversation where I had someone and I was like ranting on, or I won't say ranting, I was arguing a point about the importance of the arts, and then someone just turning to me was like, but they do understand that you're in your own little echo chamber. And let me just say that.
Totally fine, but like...
Go on.
Who cares what people who don't want to do interesting shit think?
Yeah. But I'm saying it's based on the power. Unfortunately, some of those people still... Well, everyone has the power to vote in whoever who may be doing all this.
And we are seeing the consequences of boring people with no ideas now being unpopular in the political sphere.
But the advent of the wage that is... Is it in or suggested to come in?
It'll be piloted next year.
Yeah, so that you can still earn a wage without it being filtered through a system of funding, let's say. That you can go away and think for a while or create this bananas art that I want to get involved in and help make as well. That you don't have to... You're still going to get your weekly wage. You're going to make rent. You're going to make bills. You're going to be okay with that without having to channel it through a certain way, which... I think it's a good thing. But I'll also say that the TikTokification of You, Ming, and Sanandum, the short film that changed my life, I got a request this week because somebody saw that little clip of me on TikTok to be in a show. So I'm not on TikTok, but my niece said, oh, that's my uncle, we can do something with that. And so with TikTok, that new generation of social media will possibly get me a job in the coming weeks from that. So I think with how we tell stories in different ways, and again, going back to the, it doesn't necessarily have to be Irish, because a kid in Australia or in Belgium, whatever, will look at their phone and you're swiping through and you don't know if it's Irish, but you've just seen something that's engaging or artistic or fun and, you know, that you just want to go, I want to see more of that.
Yeah.
Please, so.
I'm still waiting for Pedigree Chum to call about my dog. She's amazing.
Here is your platform.
I just wanted to ask everyone why they do what they do. And I know that can be a hard question, but like, I'll speak for myself. And actually, I was going to say, but I actually don't feel it. I think I do it because it makes me happy, but then a lot of the time I'm actually not that happy. I'm like, is it because of that? But I'll ask you. I'm not positive.
I shouldn't have sat beside the
teacher. Yeah, go on.
Why do I do what
next.
I do?
Why do you do what you do?
I don't really know. And the cheap answer is to say that I have to, but that's a very cheap answer. I don't know. But, you know, I fought tooth and nail to try and do it. I don't know why.
That's good.
Sorry.
Billy?
Yeah, I like that answer. Yeah, I don't know why I do it, really. I don't know if that needs answering. And I don't always like doing it, but I do often love doing it. And I guess for me, the idea of constantly learning and often failing and trying to be better and just being part of a kind of a wider conversation of artists and audiences is thrilling for me. And, you know, to go back to the idea of a charmed life, I arrived in this industry in theatre with nothing, including no education, and have made it this far and have fought very hard to be in the arena. So I ain't going anywhere, frankly.
Philip?
Yeah, I think it sounds like such a cliche, but it's never actually been it's never been a consideration. It's never been an option. I've always wanted to do it, and I just kind of automatically fell into it from a very, very young age, and I never questioned it at all. I think I had a goat farm for a little bit, but, you know. Never mind that.
Did you actually?
Yeah, I did, for 6 years.
I want a goat farm.
But I danced with my goats.
Unlike the rest of us, show business chose you.
Show business chose me. Yeah. But don't worry, you can work in a way.
And Una, why do you do what you do?
I don't know. I don't really think about it like the guys are saying. I think it's like, to be real, you know, to try and live the truest way that you can. You know.
Yeah. That's a good answer. Paddy?
I'm going to rob from Philly and say that what he said earlier on, I kind of get a kick out of living on the margins. And it's just that I probably where I grew up and like the environment I was in, there was never a chance to do that. So living on the margins and bringing a smile to people. I love the giddy. I enjoy the giddy. I think I always get up in the morning to find those who are the giddy. So join the giddy gang.
Brilliant. Okay, so we're going to wrap up. And I just want to say thank you for everything you do in your careers on behalf of everyone who's engaged in your work. I always talk as well about sometimes you don't get enough thank yous, and you don't. And you might do something and everyone's like, oh, that was very great. But like, I appreciate what you do, whatever that fucking means. And I think everyone around this table appreciates each other. I hope that we'll continue to be there for each other and other people in our community. And do reach out if you think people need your help. And thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I nearly got emotional at the end. I was like, thanks so much.